ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dead on the air. We're dead on the air.
Welcome to Dad's on the Air for June the 9th, 2009. Should be an interesting show coming up. First up, we've got Ben Peacock. He's talking about his new book, Tales from My Left Testicle. It happens to be International Men's Health Week. So we have two people talking about men's health today. Ben Peacock, who, of course, suffered from testicular cancer. The only other dad I can think of we've had on with testicular cancer was Mark Latham many years ago, and he spoke quite movingly about the whole thing. And also we'll have Dr. Rodney Seidler. He's an addiction expert and expert in men's health. He also runs a blog. He calls himself the King's Cross Doctor. Really fascinating bloke, so that should be an interesting interview as well. Don't forget you can listen to this program later at our new website, www.dadsontheair.net. That's .net. And you can also listen to it live streaming via the 2GLF website. In the studio today, we have Phil York from Dads in Distress.
Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone.
Greg Anderson, our researcher.
Good morning, everyone.
And Rock and Pop.
How are you, John?
Peter Vanderford and myself, John Stapleton. So welcome to the show. There's been a huge amount of debate, I must say, over family law at the moment, and there's been quite some a number of articles around looking at the issue. There's one just recently. Oh, look, Phil, can you?
Yeah, sure. These articles are all written by the same reporter, Caroline Ovington, from The Australian. She's written three articles, the first of which appeared in The Australian on the 29th of May, and its headline is Parents' Law Ties Women to Men. Wives who follow their husbands to remote corners of Australia in search of work may find themselves stuck to their new hometown, unable to leave the children. The family court has ruled that new shared parenting laws brought in by the Howard government in 2006 mean that the right of a child to have a relationship with both parents trumps the right of a mother to return to her home state, even if she has lived in the new location for less than a year. It goes on to say that that the judges consider the idea that women or mums could go where there is extended family support for them and their children. But then when you read down and you actually have a look at the remarks that the judge put against this case, he says that he gained the distinct impression that the mother was perhaps even unknowingly continuing to minimise and failed to recognise the importance of the father in the life of the child. He goes on to say that the mother unfortunately gave him the distinct impression that she was somewhat self-censored also in her position with regard to the child. So that's the first report. The second report on the very next day, on the 30th of May, headlines, Agony of Children at Divorce Has Clout. The family court has at last recognised the agony children suffer during divorce by forcing their warring parents to live close to each other, says a campaigner for the reform introduced by the Howard government. Michael Green, QC, a family law expert who campaigned for the Shared Parenting Amendment enacted in 2006, said yesterday, recent decisions prove that the right of a child to have a meaningful relationship with both parents after separation was being taken seriously by the court. The Australian reported yesterday on the case of Rosa and Rosa, which is the one that I just mentioned in regards to the remote town in Queensland. And then on the 1st of June, Caroline Ovington follows up with yet another article in The Australian, and this one reads, Divorced Mums Forced to Stay Put. New laws governing the custody of children are being used to prevent mothers from moving even a short distance from the family home after a divorce, according to experts in the field. Non-custodial parents, usually fathers, are able to use the laws to claim that such a move will deny their children the right to spend substantial and significant time with both parents as required by the new law. So there's three stories, and in 2 days, Australian, if I can get it out of my little mess here. Courts allow mums to take kids overseas. The next instalment of Caroline Ovington's reports. And she says here the family court is allowing mothers to leave their home state and even the country to establish a new life for themselves and their children, despite the introduction of a shared parenting law that encourages a meaningful relationship with both parents. So with all these reports, I don't know, it's part of it in this one today. It says that the family court is allowing mothers to leave their home state, and then in other cases it's saying that it's not allowing mothers to go back to their home state. So there's obviously a lot of differences.
Yeah, there's a massive amount of confusion around the subject at the moment, and the Rudd government would certainly appear as if it was very inclined to reverse the small. We were very critical on this program of the very small reforms that took place in family law, but the Rudd government seems to be winding them back. It's a very interesting debate. Sunday Herald Sun on the 7th of June calls for overhaul of family law system by Laurie Novel. He writes, child welfare campaigners call for an overhaul of the family law system, citing statistics they claim show courts have forced children to spend time with abusive or violent parents. And, of course, there's a huge campaign, and it's an anti-father campaign, claiming that the court is giving custody or access to violent and abusive fathers. And, of course, you know, virtually every separated dad is painted in that manner. Campaigner Barbara Briggs says an analysis of the latest family court statistics shows courts are forcing children to spend time with parents they fear. Sorry, a recent speech by the Family Court's Chief Justice Diana Bryant appears to confirm this, she claims, but the Family Court has rejected the analysis. The court says each case is determined on its merits and much of the contact between parents and children under the court's orders is supervised. The court data shows children in at least 267 separated families in 2007-2008 were forced to spend time with parents who the court deemed abusive or violent. The critics of all this say that the family court gives custody to violent, abusive, drunken and drug-addicted women every day of the week, and nobody raises an eyebrow. But the mere thought that a father might get contact with their children is the subject of much hysteria. The fathers before the court, this group claims a third were awarded less than 30% custody, and 29% of those cases it was because of abuse or family violence. Of course, this is a he said, she said jurisdiction, and not known as the Palace of Lies for nothing. There's a lot of concern about false allegations in the system and the massive damage that they do. Ms. Briggs claims that up to 15,000 children might have been forced to have contact with violent parents, read dads, over the past 5 years. Well, in a public lecture at the Queensland University of Technology in April, Chief Justice Bryant said in a third of litigated cases, the family court ordered the children spend 30% or less time with their father. And she said abuse or family violence was a major reason why this order was made. In 9% of litigated cases, the family court ordered that children spend 30% or less time with their mother, the major reason being the presence of health issues, mental health issues, no doubt. A spokeswoman for the family court said each case is judged on its merits and statistics tend to make it look as though they are all the same. There's been a huge amount of controversy. The chat lines and so on have lit up around this debate over the last week or two, and a lot of controversy around there. Are there any meetings, DIDS meetings, coming up in Western Sydney?
Yes, although DIDS has run out of funding, as we've reported on this show in previous weeks, it doesn't mean that the organisation is closing its doors as such. We have a great band of volunteers that work tirelessly for just the sake of helping someone else out in the community. We have our weekly meetings continuing tonight at Penrith, tomorrow night at Bankstown, Thursday night Liverpool, and Monday nights in Rusey Hill. And if anyone would like any more information, they can go to the Dads in Distress website, www.dadsindistress.asn.au, or they can phone me on 0401 426 101. And with that, we'll go to a break.
She's freaky, but I like it. She likes the way it hits her lips. She gets drooled about him. It sends her on a trip so right. She might be going home with me tonight. And she looks like a model, except she's got a little more ass. Don't even bother unless you got that thing she likes. Oh, I hope she's going home with me tonight. She shuts the room down. The way she walks and causes a fuss. The baddest in town. She's flawless like some uncut eyes. Well, I hope she's going home with me tonight. Oh. And all she wants is to dance. That's why you'll find her on the floor. But you don't have a chance unless you move the way that she likes. That's why she's going home with me tonight.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
Dad's in Distress, 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
And we're talking with Ben Peacock. He's the author of a new book, Lessons from My Left Testicle, A Turbulent Tale, to help put life in perspective. You there, Ben?
G'day, I am. How's it going, John?
Ah, good, 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 good. Thanks very much for coming on to Dad's on the Air. Coincidentally, it's International Men's Health Week, so it's very appropriate.
Indeed it is.
Now, I guess the thing that struck me just to read your book was it's just such an ordinary tale. You just sound like a nice, ordinary bloke, basically. You found a lump at 3 a.m. in the pub.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that was exactly it. I was an ordinary bloke doing ordinary things. It was a 3 a.m. in the pub was a mate's bucks night, actually. And I hadn't been feeling well all day, and I kind of I had this pain in my groin, and I kind of felt down there and felt lumps on my testicle, which I thought that was no good. So I went home via the kebab shop, of course, and straight home via the kebab shop.
Yes,
and then,
of course.
And
you usually feel your balls at 3 a.m., no doubt.
Well, that's it. A few people have questioned that. I'd had this sort of pain that had been going through there all day, so it took me till 3 a.m. to actually go and check my balls. My story anyway, I don't know if I'm sticking to it.
Yes, fair enough. Fair enough. Yes, and after the kebab shop, you got home to your long suffering in this case. Well, that's how it went.
She wasn't quite long suffering yet, but I would like to hope the suffering was about to begin. I went home and she sort of went, that's a bit unusual too. And then the next day I went to the doctor and he said, oh yeah, that's unusual, but it should be okay, sort of thing. But he sent me off for an ultrasound, and then the ultrasound people had very long faces as they checked it out, and they told me that it looked awfully like testicular cancer, and that was it. So that was a Monday by now, after 3 a.m. Saturday night, and then on Tuesday morning it's off to hospital for the start of a very long journey.
Jeez. And how... Well, it's quite graphic in your book, just that how you felt when you got the news. You were there basically on your own, and went to ring up your wife, but for that, just walking into the park opposite the hospital and all of that. How big a shock was it for you?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's about as big as it can get, isn't it? You know,
it's pretty <well. laughs>
I mean, the thing is, you know, in hindsight, I know so much about it all. And I know how it turned out, apart from anything else. But at the time, like, and testicular cancer is one of those things that is a reasonably good chance of getting through it. It's one of the most curable forms of cancer. But of course, I don't know that at the time. So you're standing there, and this young girl who's probably about 25 who does the actual ultrasound, which is embarrassing enough as it is, and then she kind of goes, I think we better take this one to the main doctor and the specialist, and he's out the back in this back room, which is a bit like the Wizard of Oz, and he kind of told me, listen, mate, this is probably testicular cancer. We can't be sure, but it probably is. And at that stage, you don't hear, you know, this is testicular cancer. You hear, this is cancer. And then I think most of us kind of feel that that's basically that you're being told you're going to die, you know.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much how I felt. So you... Yeah, it's all
and that sort of probing and prodding, like by that young woman, you know, that line of hers, if my grandma knew how many balls I'd seen, she'd turn in a grave. These are sort of medical professionals, basically, who aren't too concerned about the dignity of your manhood.
To be fair, she was very good, but I mean, you can't be concerned when you're doing these things. I mean, it's a case of drop your pants, and then they get this gooey gel and rub it all over it, which is for the ultrasound to work properly. And I mean, lying there with your pants down, getting this kind of, you know, there's like a pricing gun almost, sort of you know, a barcode gun thing rubbed over your private parts. It's pretty hard. She was as dignified as she could be. I mean, they try and look at the screen rather than what they're doing. But at the end of the day, you know. The way it goes.
So, you're in hospital by Tuesday, and then what happens?
Well, look, I mean, I went and saw the specialist on the Monday afternoon, So after I got found, I found this all out. We were only at Monday lunchtime, even with this, with the girl in the ultrasound room. And then Monday evening was off to see a specialist, which I was lucky I could get in so fast. And he basically said, "Mate, it's pretty good chance of testicular cancer. You're going to have to chop your ball off." And they, then, of course, you kind of, you know, you go, no, let's play, let's get a second opinion, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of fun.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there is no second opinion to be had. It's, I mean, I went to, my great second opinion was the internet, which is very good for these things, and it's, and at the end of the day, that it's part of the diagnosis. It's not even part of the treatment, whereby the doctors being doctors, they take a very doctor kind of look at these things, and they say, "Listen, if we go and take a cross section of this testicle, then there's a chance that if it is cancerous, it'll spread by us cutting it open. So we take the whole testicle off, and then we test it." And I said, "But doesn't that mean I lose a testicle? Even, you know, isn't this like, what if it's okay?" And they said, "Don't worry, you've got another one. You'll be fine either way. You can live life with one testicle." So
yes,
their opinion is basically better safe than sorry. And, and it's not till they've taken it out and then chopped it open, that chopped it in half and had a look at the lump, that they can tell you whether it's cancer or not. Which, of course, it was.
It was. Yeah. The only other chap we've had on in your predicament was Mark Latham, who was very entertaining on the same subject.
Really?
Say.
I didn't know he was a...
Yeah.
Fella, so there you go.
Yeah, you've got a very famous namesake. Yes, he stuck his clomping boots up on the table here in the studio and waxed forth, encouraging all men to...
Can you get your balls checked?
Yeah, just like... because the men don't get this message, do they? Like, there's a massive blitz of publicity for women and breast cancer and so on and so forth, and huge numbers of public health messages encouraging women to look after themselves, but not so much for men, is it?
No, it's so true. I mean women are a little bit more careful about these things too, you know. Guys are kind of a bit more she'll be right about it.
I mean
I was watching the footy last night, and the ref's in pink, you know, which is great, and it's good that this all happens, but you go, geez, like even breast cancer's even got, you know, the ultimate blokes game on their side.
Oh, I know. I often wonder, why aren't they doing anything for men's health while they're running around, you know, big puffy. Amazing, isn't it?
And I mean, I think you know the breast cancer lobby has been, it's a beacon of how to do it. You know, they've done such a good job of it. They've gone across everything. It's just, I think there's more urgency around it to some degree, because it is a little more prevalent, the women's stuff, but I think there's a bit more solidarity there, or people maybe the time on their hands, whereas the men's cancers, I think people who survive them have a habit of kind of wanting to tuck it away in the closet a bit more. You know, they don't want to talk about it, whereas women will talk about it, which I think is sad. But, I mean, there is stuff, and men's... The Movember is in part for men's cancers. It's also for depression. It's sort of men's health issues generally.
They're doing a great job. So, now, you're in the hospital. Tell us what happened.
Well, getting your ball chopped off, you discover, is apparently a minor operation.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm thinking minor to you, you know, not to me. But probably the most bizarre moment is when they come up to you with a form, and it says sign here. I said, "What am I signing?" And it's to say you're authorising the operation, and you're literally signing away your testicle, you know. Okay, there you go.
Oh, my God.
Are you going to give me some money for this as well? Something. But no, so I think it was a 7 a.m. operation, something like that. It was very early. And by midday, I was back home.
Oh, my God.
Feeling a little sore, but nothing. But within 3 days, you can get up and walk around again. It's sort of an easy one, but that was the easy part. The hard part starts after that, when they discovered it had spread, and it was not just in the testicle. And then it's when you start talking about chemo and bigger operations, you know, which all happens.
Right. All right, we'll take a quick break and we'll come back and move on. It's International Men's Week, so it's a good day to be talking about these sorts of issues and to encourage men to go to the doctor. You know, they don't go to the doctor very often, and it's wise to be sensible. We'll be back. We're talking with Ben Peacock. He's the author of a new book, Lessons from My Left Testicle, A Turbulent Tale to Help Put Life in Perspective. We'll be back in a moment.
go-go and wish that I was dead. With an aching in my head, I lay motionless in bed. I thought of you and where you gone. Let the world spin round. And everything that I said I'd do, like make the world brand new, we'll take the time for you. I just got lost and slept right through the dark, and the world spins round. Say goodbye. I watch the stars from my windowsill. The whole world is moving and I'm standing still. I woke up, wish that I was dead, with an aching in my head, I lay motionless in bed. The night is here, and the day is gone, and the world spins madly on. I thought of you, and where you're gone, and the world spins madly on. And the world spins madly on. And the world spins madly on.
And we're talking with the author of Lessons from My Left Testicle, A Turbulent Tale to Help Put Life in Perspective, Ben Peacock. You there?
I am indeed.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air.
What
a tale to tell, really. It's a bloke's worst nightmare, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty much up there. I think there's one thing more. There's one thing you could learn. Lose worse.
That's about it. Oh, dear, yeah. How did you find other men treated you, and or were they sympathetic, or they just didn't want to know, or they were curious, or what?
Mate, you end up in a bit of a cocoon for the whole process, you know, in that everything is either in hospital, learning about the next thing, dealing with what's just happened. There's not a lot of kind of, it's almost like I was cut off from the rest of the world for about 6 months, you know, just sort of between hospital and home and my wife and a few other people. So, I mean, the main guys that you meet are your friends, you know, so they're obviously sympathetic. Well, they're probably not your friends anymore.
Yeah, I guess. Your wife sounds wonderfully supportive too.
What's that, sorry?
Your wife sounds wonderfully supportive woman.
Oh, she's amazing. And I mean, that's such a massive lesson of these things, you know. If she hadn't have been, it would be so much harder, you know. She was there for the whole thing pretty much, and she was a bastion of strength and really helped me through. And her parents and my own parents as well were great. They gave us a place to live, and my we were halfway through renovating a new flat, which was completely unlivable because we'd kind of done all the ripping apart bit, but not the putting back together bit. You know, and my dad went in and finished that off. So I mean, those sort of, and with some of my friends too, actually. But you know, things like that you just can't put a price on. You know, it's like, because people looking after all those things around you means you've got the time and the energy to focus on what you've got to do, which is get better, and that's so important.
So you're really lucky to have that sort of support around you. How would you have coped without it?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is it. You know, you kind of, I think we live in this society where we feel that there's a kind of a bit of cushioning for us if these things go wrong. But, I mean, what you discover is there's nothing. You know, the government's useless. I went to Centrelink and they made me go through 8 weeks of interviews to tell me that I couldn't have anything and Annabelle could have 46 cents a fortnight, you know.
But really?
They wouldn't tell me that at the start of the process. I had to go through an 8-week process and I was getting in between chemo and I was going in and I couldn't walk properly because I'd had this massive operation that, you know, cut a foot long, I've got a foot long scar down my middle, you know. And 2 weeks later, I'm in there debating this with Centrelink, just saying, listen, guys, can you just tell me if it's worth going through the process? No, you have to go through the process. And their end result was, well, you own an apartment, which, of course, I didn't really own, you know, the bank owns it, like everyone else, you know, new mortgage. Yeah. So sell that. That's their answer to the whole thing, you know. So this is it. I mean, I feel for people who don't have some sort of, you know, if you didn't have someone around and you didn't have a job who's prepared to support you. I mean, I didn't have a job at the time. I was working freelance. So, it was, you know, you're only as good as your next kind of thing to come in. It's not like, but a place I had worked in the past sent us a bunch of groceries and, you know, those sorts of things are, it's just so important, getting through this sort of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, no. So do you think, did you have a particularly good personality to be able to cope with this sort of crisis, or...?
I don't think I'm any different to anyone else, you know. I mean, one of the things you said at the start, you know, you're an ordinary person going through this stuff. I think what you find with these things is you kind of go, geez, how do people do that? And then when it's you, you realise how they do it. It's because you don't have a choice, mate. And so, you learn to make the best of a bad situation and you just do what it takes to get through because what's the other option?
So you're in the hospital. You've just had, you know, you've just lost your left testicle. And they then discover what fairly quickly that it has spread. Is that what happened?
Yeah, they found, it's called the spermatic cord, which is the cord that goes to your testicle, and they found traces in there, which meant it had escaped at some point. So what happens with cancer is it gets around two ways. It either goes through your lymph nodes, or it goes through your bloodstream, or both. Yeah. And so what they did next is said, well, listen, we want to go in and take out some of your lymph nodes, which, you know, basically will take out all the lymph nodes are sort of connected, so we'll take out the next two rows, you know, the ones closest to the one closest to your testicle, so the next row after that, and actually the next row after that, so actually three rows. And to do that, though, they needed to actually cut from just under my, just you know, under your, kind of your breastbone, if you like, where your sternum is, all the way down past my belly button, and then they take all your guts out and stick them all on a tray. And then they go right in and all your lymph nodes are up against your backbone, so they don't want to go in through your back, obviously. So they take out all these lymph nodes, I think it's 15 of them, and then they stuff all your guts back in, and of course your guts don't quite fit back in, like when you dig a hole and the dirt doesn't fit back in when you try to put it in. So then they literally staple you back together.
so you get 43 staples.
And then you're left with this massive beer gut, if you like. I'm pretty lean generally, but I had this huge gut that came out because it's all pressing up against it. And of course, that makes it impossible to walk. And I couldn't do sit-ups for about 18 months afterwards. It took that long for that to heal, you know.
So that eventually goes, does it? The swollen belly and all that.
Yeah, that took about 6 weeks to go down, by which time you've been walking around hunched over for 6 weeks, so your back is just... really sore.
They literally put all your insides on a table. Oh my goodness.
That's exactly right. I almost wish I had a photo of that for some macabre way. This is what Earth looks like. So finally I could walk again and I could walk around and I felt good. And they said, "Radio, that's great that you feel good, because now we have to deal with anything that got in your bloodstream, which means you need to go and do 3 months of chemo." Your reward for overcoming one operation is chemotherapy.
Oh, dear. And how did you cope with the chemotherapy?
The chemo's the worst of it all.
Really?
It's just a living hell, yeah. I mean, different chemos for different things. You know, some people go through chemo for other forms of cancer and they report that it's not that bad. But testicular cancer has a particularly heavy dose of chemo, partly because, you know, testicular cancer tends to hit young, fit males, so they can hit you pretty hard and they're not going to kill you. But I think also, you know, the fact is that there's a good chance that they can sort out the cancer altogether with it, so they go quite hard with it.
But, right. Because
yeah, but the chemo, it's living hell. Best I can put it.
So why did you write the book? What motivated you to do it? What was it like doing it?
Mate, it's I started out just writing my thoughts down during the whole process when I was going through it. Because I'll tell you what you find is, I mean, when you're facing a death situation or a potential death situation, what I found is you get this real kind of clarity on what's worth living for, if you like. And so what I found was you don't want to lose that, you know. You're giving so much for this newfound kind of wisdom. Mm. You know, give me a testicle and all this other pain, you know. So I started writing these little emails to people just to really not for them so much as for me, you know, something to when you write something down, you kind of understand it better.
Yeah.
And what happened that was a bit strange is I kept getting emails back, but they weren't from the people that I'd sent them to. They were from other people that they'd passed them on to.
Right.
And then it was actually a guy called Paul Wilson, who's a friend who wrote The Little Book of Calm. He's quite a well-known writer. Oh, so yes. He's been hugely
successful with those books too.
He's very successful. He said 10 million or something.
Oh, no, he's made millions out of the simplest idea. And you can, all those thousands of people struggling to write the great masterpiece Australian novel, and he's made a fortune out of something like that.
The little books. Yeah, he actually has written a fair few big books as well. But I think the little book was his sort of little money spin, and all the rest of them have got the more meaty stuff in it. But, he said to me, why don't you write a book about this? And so after going through it all, I kind of took the emails I'd sent out and made them the sort of the basic structure of how the book would be, and they end up being like about 5 pages in the book. They're almost nothing, you know, compared to the book now. But back to, you know, why did I write it? In a funny way, it's a very selfish thing to write these things, because you almost write them so that you can forget or move on. When you write something down, I know now that at any time I can go back and read the book and understand exactly what I understood at the time and feel exactly what I felt at the time, because it's very much, you know, written along the way of the journey and then or just after it. So it means for me I can move on and not have to keep thinking about it and going, oh, I better not forget about all those great things I learned, you know, because it's all there in a book.
Yeah, that's good. That's, really smart. How common is testicular cancer in young men like yourself?
It's not a common thing, thankfully, but it's the second biggest killer. So of guys aged, I think, I don't have the exact stats, but it's like 18 to 40 or 18 to 35, something
right.
like that.
So yeah.
It's, I think it hits, and don't quote me on any of these statistics because I've kind of forgotten a few of them, but I think it hits about 1 in 300 guys,
right.
which is not too bad, but then when you think about it, there's an awful lot of, you know, there's Australia's 20 million or something divided by 300. There's still a lot of guys, you know.
That's a lot of guys, yeah.
Yeah, so...
And does it normally hit younger or older men?
All about older guys, younger guys, sorry. It's, not all about, but general rule, the sweet
younger,
spot
younger
for
men.
It, if you like. I think the average age is 26 or something around there.
Really?
And it's, there are guys that get it up in their 50s. It can happen. It's just more unusual. But generally, if you hit 40, you're kind of past the likelihood. So it used to be called sportsman's cancer, actually, because you get a lot of guys like Lance Armstrong's the obvious example, but there's a few American football players, and Craig Moore, the Aussie soccer player.
Right.
Tommy Rigodonagus had it. He's got the famous quote, "You only need one ball to play rugby." And this is the thing, you know, cancer is typically associated with guys, people who don't treat themselves so well, you know. I mean, that's what everyone thinks.
It's
a bit of a furphy in itself, but certainly this one is, it tends to hit young, fit males.
And there's no understanding of why, what causes it, anything you can do to prevent it, anything like that?
No, there's a couple of known things. One is if you've got an undescended testicle at birth, which I didn't, but that increases
can
your
be
chances.
Affected, yeah.
A big kick in the balls is suspected of being a possible cause, you know, years later. But I think we've all had one of those.
Most kids who've ever played soccer or been skiing or done anything, really.
And then there's other type, you know, real little minor things like it tends to be more prevalent slightly in the upper one third of the height percentile, if you know what I mean. Like, so the taller third of people tend to be more slightly more susceptible, and also when you sort of built a bit thinner rather than medium. Yeah. But these are all, you know, makes a 5% difference to your chances. You know, not a massive difference. So the bottom line is no, it's pretty much a random thing.
And so, what should men do to check themselves for the condition?
It's pretty easy. You just got to feel around that area, and if you feel lumps, you got to be worried about it. I mean, there's some sort of lumpy bits around the back of your balls, which are actually just sort of the plumbing, if you like. So they're nothing to worry about. But certainly around the other areas, the other thing you find is your ball goes a little bit harder. It sort of shrinks a little bit, goes a bit harder because the cancer is actually sucking all the blood out of it and taking the blood for itself for the tumour. But I've found actually, if you go to YouTube, if everyone's web savvy, and you type in testicular cancer examination or something along those lines, there's a heap of different videos which are kind of comical in some way, but also very useful in others. Some of them go back to the 60s and 70s where they actually show you a set of testicles and how you should be checking yourself. But the bottom line is, I think there's a lot of information comes out of the UK which says once a month, get down there and just make sure there's no lumps, you know?
Right. So out of the whole experience, what was the single most hilarious moment?
Oh, mate, the whole thing was funny. No,
yes.
You find that it's a black sort of a humour.
Yeah.
You know, I think I don't know if funny is the is the word as such. I mean, in hindsight, everything is funny, you know, like going to dinner with your parents, and I was parents-in-law, and my mum-in-law cooked me her best dish, you know, that she knew I liked the most, and I ate it, and within 5 minutes I was throwing it up. It's things like that which are not really funny at the time at all, but you've got to find some humour in them. There's all the little things about, you know, if you can pass wind in the hospital bed, then they'll take the catheter out and things like that. So you spend all this time to see if you can brew up something to impress the nurses to let you move on to the next stage of getting better, you know, all these sorts of things that are, as I say, they're not funny at the time, but, you know, you've got to look on the bright side, don't you?
Yeah. And the worst moment of the whole thing?
Jeez, worst moment. It's, I think the worst moment when I was in hospital one night and I think I had too much of the morphine. They give you a little button to push, and it slows your breath. I didn't realise this. No one ever told me this, but it and I woke up, and I think it was like my breathing had slowed during my sleep, and so I woke up and I couldn't breathe.
Mm.
And the other thing about it is morphine does have slightly, it does affect your mind slightly. It makes it everything, it's a little bit psychedelic. So I kind of woke up unable to breathe in this black room, and I didn't know where I was. I couldn't remember what was going on. Then, of course, you realize you've got this tube down your throat that's sort of metal tube, and you've got a catheter in. And that was pretty freaky, and I had to kind of get Annabelle, my wife, to wake up and open the hospital door, and I felt like I was in hell. I had this strange feeling I was literally in hell. And when she opened the hospital door up, I looked out, and it was just that plain hospital carpet and those boring grey walls, and I suddenly felt okay again, you know, because I could just see boring, ordinary world out there.
Oh,
so that was pretty harsh.
Right, so people to get the book, how can they get it?
Mate, it's in, I've seen it in a few Dimmick stores and Angus and Robertson. I've seen it in Berkelow and Ariel, if anyone lives near those places.
Yes.
And if you can't be asked going to the bookstore or your local one doesn't have it, then if you go online to, there's a website, constantreader.com.au, who has it?
Yeah.
It's constantreader.com.au. You can actually, if you Google it, there's a couple of other bookstores who also deliver it, and some of them actually got a bit cheaper online than the ordinary bookstores too.
Oh,
so
good, eh?
So, yeah.
Okay, so thank you very much. We've been talking with Ben Peacock. He's the author of a new book, Lessons from My Left Testicle, A Turbulent Tale to Help Put Life in Perspective. So thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air.
Well, mate, thank you very much. I enjoyed it very much. Cheers.
No, great. Thank you.
Okay.
We'll be back.
problem is all inside your head, she said to me. The answer is easy if you take it logically. I'd like to help you in your struggle to be free. There must be 50 ways to leave your lover. She said it's really not my habit to intrude. Furthermore, I hope my meaning won't be lost or misconstrued. But I'll repeat myself at the risk of being crude. There must be 50 ways to leave your lover. 50 ways to leave your lover. You just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. Just get yourself free. Or hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key, Lee, and get yourself free. Ooh, slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. You just listen to me. Hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key, Lee, and get yourself free. She said, it grieves me so to see you in such pain. I wish there was something I could do to make you smile again. I said, I appreciate that. And would you please explain about the 50 ways? She said, why don't we both just sleep on it tonight? And I believe in the morning you begin to see the light. And then she kissed me, and I realized she probably was right. There must be 50 ways to leave your lover. 50 ways to leave your lover. You just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. Just get yourself free. Or you hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key, Lee, and get yourself free. Slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. You just listen to me. Hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key, Lee, and get yourself free.
Grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you're ever there anyway.
Dad's in Distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dad's in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air. We're going to play an excerpt now from a BBC Radio 4 program called More or Less. This aired in the UK a couple of weeks ago and it's been circulated on the internet. A guy called Tim Harford does some really good detective work looking at a domestic violence statistic that's been floating around in government circles in the UK since the mid-1990s, and it makes very interesting listening. So here we are, Tim Harford from BBC Radio 4.
Loyal listener Frank Fisher, also a political blogger, asked us to have a listen to a surprising figure on the 10 o'clock news in March.
The government says incidents of domestic violence have fallen substantially, but it still affects one in four women. Indeed, for women aged between 15 and 44, it's the biggest cause of mortality.
What was that? Domestic violence kills more women between 15 and 44 than anything else. You might think that the 10 o'clock news would check such a striking number. But in fairness, they aren't the only ones. The Kent Police made a very similar claim, that domestic violence was the leading cause of death for women between 19 and 44. The Guardian has said that globally, violence against women, not just domestic violence, was the leading cause of death for 15 to 44-year-olds. This claim mutates as it circulates. A milder strain claims that domestic violence is the leading cause of morbidity in women aged 15 to 44. Just a reminder, mortality means death, morbidity means ill health. This milder strain has appeared in a number of official publications, most notably a 2005 Home Office document called Domestic Violence, a National Review. It's subsequently been asserted by the Home Affairs Select Committee, the Crown Prosecution Service, the Ministry of Justice and others. It's pretty common for a rogue statistic to spread and mutate like this, and the likely explanation is that people keep misquoting each other rather than going to a credible original source. That was what we did. We trawled through figures from the Office for National Statistics, and it's clear that for England and Wales, the 10 o'clock news statistic is, thankfully, completely wrong. In the year 2007, nearly 6,000 women aged between 15 and 44 died. What you claim as the largest cause of death depends on how broad your categories are, but over 2,000 of those deaths were from cancer and other tumours. 1,100 women were killed by external causes, which would include domestic violence, but also includes other assaults, suicides and all kinds of accidents. It seems as though the BBC 10 o'clock news and others have simply confused mortality and morbidity. It's an open and shut case. But there's more to the story than that. What about the global figures? And does the morbidity claim hold water? We asked Colin Mathers, the man in charge of statistics on death and the burden of disease at the World Health Organization. I asked him what the leading cause of death is globally in women aged 15 to 44.
Well, for the world as a whole, it is HIV/AIDS is the leading cause of death in that age group, followed by tuberculosis and then suicide.
And do we know how many deaths are due to domestic violence? Or is that not a category that the WHO collect?
We do collect information on homicide, and you know, domestic violence leading directly to death from an injury would be classified as homicide, and so it is part of that. There is no doubt that there are studies that show that a considerable proportion of homicides in women in this age range are committed by intimate partners.
But is homicide, just taken as a standalone category, is that a major cause of death?
It's not in the 10 leading causes globally, or I've pulled out numbers for Britain. It's not in the top five for Britain. Suicide is the second leading cause in Britain in this age group. A proportion of suicides would probably be the result of domestic violence.
What are the numbers on morbidity? What's the leading cause of morbidity globally?
We use a measure called the DALY, which essentially is quantifying lost years of healthy life.
So and so, disability-adjusted life years?
That's right. And so somebody who has a mild joint problem might be considered to have lost a small fraction of a healthy year of life for each year they live. Somebody who has dementia or blindness or paraplegia would be considered to have lost the equivalent of a much larger fraction of their year of life. In terms of that loss of healthy years of life, at a global level, depression is the leading cause of lost healthy life in women aged 15 to 44. That's followed by schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. So three mental disorders are responsible for the most lost of healthy years of life from the non-fatal conditions. If you add up the lost years from people dying as well, then the rankings obviously will be different.
Is there any way to do these sums that makes it credible to say that domestic violence is the leading cause of morbidity in women aged 15 to 44?
Domestic violence is certainly a significant risk factor, one of the contributors to loss of health, but I doubt very much it'll be the leading one. At a global level, at least, unsafe sex is probably going to be the leading risk factor in this group because HIV/AIDS is up there as the leading cause of death.
Colin Mathers of the WHO. So where did this statistic come from? Since the Home Office confidently asserted it in the ministerial forward to their 2005 document, Domestic Violence, a National Review, we asked them where they got it from. They gave us a statement in which they said the statistic was used for illustrative purposes. Now there's some fine print for you. They also pointed us to the World Bank's World Development Report for 1993. But even the World Bank's 1993 research shows domestic violence and rape in sixth place as a source of morbidity. So it seems that from that original claim in 1993, there have been multiple bouts of statistical inflation. The 1993 table showed rape and domestic violence as the sixth largest cause of morbidity in women aged 15 to 44 globally. leaving to one side the difficulties in collecting that statistic, morbidity then mutated into mortality. Global figures were used in the UK without any mention that they were global figures. Rape was dropped from the category without making any adjustments, and the whole lot was booted up the league table from sixth place to first place. Thank goodness for illustrative purposes. Otherwise, I'd be worried that a bogus statistic had echoed around the world, copied apparently without question into official reports, news bulletins, and policy documents. And of course, there's another very important question. How serious is the problem of domestic violence? I spoke to Professor Sylvia Wolby of Lancaster University, who's been working on the problem of improving the statistics both in the UK and across the world. I asked her how the data was collected in the UK.
It's collected with great difficulty. It should be collected in the official criminal statistics, but that's very difficult because there isn't an official crime code for domestic violence. So it has to be pieced together in a very awkward kind of way.
So you have assault, murder, but you don't have domestic violence.
That's right. So you have to rely upon additional coding by the police to say that the incident was domestic. Otherwise, you don't know whether the assault was by a man on another man in the street or whether it was a domestic incident. So that's quite awkward. But the police are beginning to collect those figures, but they're not yet properly in the public domain, which is very disappointing. The other way of collecting the figures is to do a survey, and you ask people what's happened to them in the last year, have they suffered any crimes? And we now have within the British Crime Survey a set of specialised questions on domestic violence, which now get asked every year. The first time they were asked in quite a lot of detail, but now they ask only a very small subset of those, so again, we have quite limited information.
Why has that part of the survey been pared down?
It's said because it's too expensive to ask the longer set of questions, but of course that's simply a matter of priorities. How much money do we want to invest in knowing exactly how much of this violence there is?
So to the extent that we have numbers we can rely on, what do they say?
Well, the best data does come from the surveys, from the British Crime Survey. And then it depends what threshold measure of domestic violence that we use. The conventional way is to say it's about 4% of women in any year will suffer domestic violence. If you take a more restrictive definition, which involves actually physical force, then it's down to 3.4%.
Some of the people that we've talked to in the course of doing this piece have suggested that we shouldn't be questioning this rogue statistic. Even though it isn't true, we shouldn't be questioning it because domestic violence is such a serious problem. Do you have sympathy with that view?
I understand the view. It is difficult to be critical of something on such an important area. But I think we've gone beyond the basics. Everybody now knows that domestic violence is a serious problem. And now we need to know exactly the scale and shape of that problem. So we do need to be querying the figures, but we do need to be improving them. And that means collecting new and better data.
Sylvia Wolby. You're listening to More or Less with me, Tim Harford.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And now we have the honour of having on the line with us Dr. Rodney Sidley. He's one of the country's leading addiction experts and also an expert in men's health. He also has a blog of his own, the King's Cross Doctor. Are you there, Dr. Sidler?
Yes, John. It's Ray.
Oh, what am I doing? Sorry.
Robbie's my younger, more attractive brother.
Oh, dear. Sorry about that. I don't know what I'm thinking.
I don't know what you think.
It's been one of those mornings.
It's 11 o'clock, you haven't had your coffee.
I've had two and I haven't had any for weeks, so there you go. Look, first of all, let's just talk about your blog to give readers an idea of the listeners of who you are, really. So what's the King's Cross Doctor blog all about?
Well, I've been in the cross for about 30 years now, and in the last couple of years, only because I've got two teenage sons who blog mercilessly,
yes.
They kind of encouraged me to publish my musings online rather than boring them to death over dinner. I think the storytelling about exotic people that I've seen in my practice over dinner, of course de-identified, is driving them to distraction. So they said, why don't you just type it up? And I said, well, I'm not much of a typist. They said, well, you've got that fancy voice recognition software. Why don't you just talk it into your computer and shove it on Blogspot? And so I did.
Wow.
I don't know how many people actually read my blog, John, though, and it's always been a mystery to me, but it seems, somebody seems to be following me, because every now and then I get somebody from the media wanting to have a chat about something that I've written.
Well, it's got some really wonderful pieces there about just some of the characters and the cross and what you see. Look, it is International Men's Health this week, and yes. And there are a lot of things that really impact on men's health. How do you see men's health in Australia today? As in a good state, or...?
No, not really. I see men as marginalised as Aborigines, and Aboriginal men even more marginalised. But it's pretty bad. And I think it's not just the health system. It's kind of this male culture that we all live in, which says, you know, I'll be all right, doctor.
Yeah.
And men are usually driven in to see the doctor by some girlfriend or wife or mother. Men are not actually proactive about primary prevention, and that's the issue. We want to see men when there's nothing wrong with them, just to have a look at them and remind them what they need to do. But men aren't very proactive about doing that. They don't like to go to the doctor. They're dragged kicking and screaming to the doctor, and they'll say things like, I don't know why I'm here, doctor. But your blood pressure's on. And, oh, yeah, it says everybody's, you know, I'm not going to take any of them freaking medications. Leave me alone, doctor. You're not putting that black snake up my ass, doctor. Things like that, you know, that's it. So whenever I get a middle-aged man who's not been to the doctor for a couple of years, I lock the door and say, you're not leaving here for 45 minutes. And I'll test everything I can, irrespective of whether they've fasted for their bloods or whether they've had anybody's index finger up their ass, or if they've, you know, if they've had their eyes tested. I'll just do everything, because you can't ever trust them to come back.
Ray, do you think you're typical of most GPs, though? I hear stories from men that they go into their GP, and it might be in one of these new medical clinics, and the GP wants to just write them a script and get out of there in 5 minutes, and it's up to the GP to maybe do what you're doing and really probe the guys and say, look, have you had this tested?
Yeah.
Let's check your blood pressure. Let's do those sort of things.
Yeah, I think the newer style medical centres are not the best place for men, unless there's a doctor there who has an interest in men's health. And I hate to malign medical centres, because I think in some ways they're not a bad idea, but they're kind of based on profit, and profit is related to fast throughput of patients. And there's not much incentive for doctors to spend a lot of time with one patient financially. So what I recommend in that situation is probably make a few appointments and go back and talk about one issue each time. Now, that sounds kind of piecemeal, but it's better than nothing. And if you can't find somebody who will sit down with you and talk about the whole problem, then perhaps go back more regularly. So you build a relationship. And I think building relationships and rapport with GPs is probably the most important thing men can do.
Absolutely. Look, I couldn't agree more. I agree that the medical centre model is not ideal. And as you say, it's probably more around the profit motive than the health and well-being motive, or at least the profit motive is higher in their thinking. Unfortunately, though, because many men work much longer hours than women, work during business hours and work often overtime, often the only clinics that are open to men are those medical centres, and so they end up in a double bind, in a sense.
So that's why a man needs to take a flexi day periodically and spend some time. I mean, most men spend more money and time on their cars by a factor of probably 10 than they do on their health. And that's a worrying statistic for me.
Absolutely.
That you'll spend more time on additives to your engine and, you know, buffing lotions to keep your car shiny and tyre, you know, tyre gloss and fuel additives and carburetors and exhausts. But when it comes to checking for bowel cancer, oh, I haven't got time.
What do you think of the... there's been some trial schemes where doctors and nurses are actually brought into large male-dominated workplaces, so maybe construction sites, maybe factories, and...
I think that's a good idea, and I think that's a really good idea. I think nurses just doing the basic stuff like blood sugars and blood pressure is a fantastic idea. And
maybe giving some advice about healthy diet and smoking and all that sort of stuff.
Simple stuff that men probably don't get much access to. And weighing them and measuring them. You know, how tall are you? How much do you weigh? What's your body mass index? You know, that's the figure that we kind of worry about. And how big is your waistline? Getting a tape measure around your waistline is probably the most important measurement you can do as a man. And realizing that you're in the frame for diabetes means that you really need to do something proactively if diabetes is around the corner. And most men don't realize they've got diabetes until it's well underway.
So apart from that, the waistline check, what are the main things, especially, I guess, for middle-aged men, if they're coming in to see you, what are the top three things that you would say? Obviously, one of them is that waist check. What are the other things that they're most likely to have problems with?
The most important thing is your family history, and most men neglect that. What did your father die of if he's dead? What is he suffering from if he's not dead? What do your uncles and aunts suffer from? What do your first-degree relatives have? If there's bowel cancer or melanoma or heart disease in the frame for your family, then you're hardwired to get these diseases and you need to be much more proactive. If your father's 85 and living independently and feeding the chooks and driving his own car and not demented, you're probably reasonably okay. But if your father died at 55 of a heart attack and you're 53... then you want to seriously think about having some cardiological investigations to make sure you're not next in line, because these diseases, we know, run through families. Bowel cancer deaths, we now know that men and women particularly, I mean everybody in Australia from the age of about 50 onwards, should have a fecal blood test for blood. And that's a simple test where you put a brush into your bowel motion and send it off, and if there's blood there, then they'll put a scope into your back passage and just check whether you've got a tumour there. Now, that's an easy thing to do. It's not invasive to start with, but it saved countless thousands of lives. And I think that probably the men listening should have a bowel blood test, bowel motion blood test, every 2 years from the age of 55 on. That should be a routine. Now, skin checks are important too, because we live in a country where skin cancer is right up there with diseases that knock people over. And somebody should strip you off and have a look at your entire skin, including between your toes and your heels and, right over you, including your scalp even, where melanomas can sometimes grow, and the barber usually picks them. And that should be done probably every 2 years. And if there's a family history of melanoma, you should see a dermatologist and get photographed if you've got a whole lot of moles, so that he can see if there's any change in the moles.
And I guess even more so if you're the kind of guy who's been working in outdoor exposed occupations,
you're a brickie, and you haven't been wearing sun protection for 30 years until it suddenly caught on about 5 years ago, then you've had 30 years of unfettered solar exposure, which is likely to prime you for cancer in your 50s and 60s. So blood pressure, cholesterol, blood sugar are the three major blood tests. Somebody should examine your prostate over the age of 50, and that means putting a gloved digit into your back passage and feeling your prostate. And somebody should possibly do a PSA, a blood test, to check your prostatic antigen. Now, there's a bit of controversy about that, but I reckon that's a reasonable thing to do. And they say that if you don't put your finger in, you put your foot in.
Now, look, I'm sure you're aware that the federal government is in the middle of developing a men's health policy at the moment.
Yes.
One of the suggestions that's come out of that is that the government may introduce a system where, just like you get a reminder from for pap smears, or men get a reminder to that their car's due for registration, yep, etc., yep, the government sends out a reminder every 12 months or maybe every 2 years to every man in Australia to say, now's the time to go to the doctor for, yep, your checkup, because as you say, men often have other priorities. Maybe, yep, they're working for their family or their cars are important things, so they're likely to forget. Do you think, yep, that's a good idea?
I do. I think men should lock into their birthdays, because I think a birthday is a good time to remember to see the doctor.
Okay.
So every birthday, go and see your GP as part of that birthday celebration.
So we particularly started off this show as a bunch of very disgruntled separated men, and of course separated men do go through a very traumatic period of, yep, their life. What are the sort of health problems that are often associated with that?
Well, we know that single men who are unattached, have a much higher rate of morbidity and mortality, and that they get sicker and die earlier than do men who are in a long-term relationship. And that men who've gone through divorce are more prone to depression, anxiety, insomnia, and all the things that commonly afflict people who are under a fair amount of stress. So men who live alone tend not to eat well. They tend not to know how to cook, which is why my three sons have learned how to cook, because ladies out there these days don't know how to cook either, and the majority of men in that age group tend to go out and eat takeaway food all the time and wonder why their waistlines are increasing in size and why their weight's going up, a kilo and a half each 6 months that they get weighed. And they say things like, you should have seen me when I was 18, Doctor, I was a ball of muscle. And I say, yeah, but now you're just a ball of fat. Oh, no, I've just got heavy bones, Doctor. Yeah, look at my wrists. And they make all sorts of excuses for why they're 110 kilos when they should be 85. And that's a huge risk factor for cancers and heart disease and high blood pressure and diabetes. And if you do one thing, it's reduce your waistline. And that means walking every day for an hour a day. And lots of blokes need to see an exercise physiologist maybe to get into an exercise program that is suitable for them. There's no good telling a bloke who's 110 kilos to go out jogging because his knees will give way in about 150 metres. And he's probably damaged his knees from years of football. And he just becomes disgruntled and then starts limping around and says he can't do any exercise at all. So you need to tailor exercise very carefully to a man's physical appearance and capacity as they get older. So I think that probably a combination of diet, exercise and regular checks are all men need to do, if only they did.
And what are some of those dietary tips? I mean, they're obvious, but you want to just run through them again?
Just eat less.
Eat less, but does that mean having a half serve of chips?
No chips at all.
Okay, so it's eating the fruit and vegetables and all that.
Yeah, eating 5 serves of fruit and vegetables a day, having no more than a fist-sized piece of meat 3 times a week, eating fish at least twice a week, and eating a non-meat meal a couple of times a week. You know, it doesn't have to be meat all the time and it doesn't have to be chips. But men have very little idea of how to prepare food, how to buy food, and I think that's probably one of the major educative things that we need to do with groups of men is teach them how to prepare food, how to shop for food, and going to the convenience store at 10 o'clock at night is not the way to shop for dinner.
But bringing it back to sort of men's working context again, I know I've done some construction work and you're out there on the site and the only food available at lunchtime for you is the van that comes around and you know, there's hot dogs and pies. Yeah. And, I'm not giving excuses, but do you suggest that men should, pack their own lunch and take it along?
If you look at Middle Eastern men and men of Italian origin, for the most part, they won't eat that food. They'll bring their own. Have you noticed that? They'll often bring a little esky full of wog food.
Yeah, bring some pasta along, or
than the pies.
Which is absolutely delicious and really healthy for you.
So we should suggest, guys, get your mate to bring along some healthy food. If he's Middle Eastern or Italian, get him to bring along some food for you.
Yeah, get his wife to do it all for you.
It means preparing an esky the night before and making your food or getting your partner to make the food for you and just taking an interest in preparing some lunch. You save a huge amount of money. Most blokes on building sites that spend $15 or $20 on lunch, that's $100 a week or $120 a week. That's a round-the-world ticket, once a year. Oh, dear. Don't say that.
And look, do you want to... I don't know, you obviously work in a city practice. You may not have a lot of... experience of this, but do you want to talk a little bit about the poor status of Indigenous men's health in Australia?
Yeah, lots of Indigenous men, mostly homeless, and it's just terrible. That's why we do health assessments on them in their early 30s, whereas in Australian men we do them at 75, because at 30 most Indigenous men are looking down the barrel at diabetes or heart disease or kidney failure. They just don't turn up for appointments. They're often very lax with their appointments, with seeing doctors. They often eat poorly and they often have drug and alcohol issues as well as poor nutrition. So it's a bad mix.
And do you see that there's any solution to this? It's such an entrenched problem.
The government initiatives at the moment to try and get them in are good, but it's hard to get them to turn up, I see them because they come in with alcohol or drug dependence and they have to do something about it, but routinely they wouldn't show.
So how common is it for blokes to shift from being, the drinker in the pub to having serious problems with alcohol or other substances? And often, of course, in a hard-drinking culture, people might not notice that they're starting to slip into addictive patterns.
Well, there are certain things that impact on that, and probably the most important one is your mental health, and if you've got a family history of addiction. So if Dad was a three-long-neck-a-day bloke and... your uncle was buried at 64 with liver disease and your other uncle died at 68 and he was an alcoholic, then you're in trouble if you're drinking sub- substantially, and you suddenly become depressed because if you break up a relationship, you're more inclined to drink more because you can't sleep, and you self-medicate with alcohol and or other drugs, and that becomes a serious issue when things don't go wrong, don't go right. So losing your job, having a car accident, little things that wouldn't throw most people into a pandemonic state might push a heavy drinker into an extreme heavy drinker.
Right. And so how common is it that...
Very common. It's the great hidden disease in Australia. I mean, I'm astounded. And I've got medical students with me who constantly are encouraged to ask men how much they drink, and when they find out, they just can't believe it. That the majority of men will either binge drink heavily on the weekend or drink steadily at a hazardous rate all through the week. And that's, you know, not having two alcohol-free days a week and drinking more than three or four standard drinks on any one day is considered hazardous these days. So the ballpark has changed and the goalposts have moved, and now we're considering that even more than one drink per day can be hazardous to your health.
Really? And yet
additional wine. Most people drink a lot more than that.
They do. So the bloke who has half a dozen schooners every night and thinks nothing of it?
He's in trouble. One, because his blood pressure's probably rising. Two, because his waistline's going up. And three, because he's doing irrevocable damage to his liver. And the likelihood of him being involved in an assault or a drink-driving offence or a fall or any number of accidents, either at the workplace or, you know, the next day, because he's probably still over the limit when he arrives at work if he's still drinking at midnight, are just extraordinary. So that's really hazardous behaviour.
But, of course, most people in that situation have no idea because they're surrounded by other people who drink very similarly or drink and drug very similarly to them. They don't see that it's an abnormal behaviour.
All my mates do the same thing, Doctor. What am I meant to do? You're taking grog away from me. What am I going to do on Saturday night? What am I going to do after work?
Yeah.
And that's a real issue because you pull the rug out from under them in terms of their social lives if you stop them drinking.
Well, this is very true, and particularly for separated men.
Yep.
They've relied on their wives as very commonly to provide their entire social circuit.
Yes.
And that's just a thing that blokes do. They let their wife organise who's coming around for the weekend.
Yes. Well, that's why in many ways a program like yours should encourage men to start to take control of their own lives and become more proactive in their social lives and other aspects of their lives. I think it's not easy, and it probably needs to start at school where boys are encouraged to become self-sufficient. I think that's the problem. We don't have self-sufficient men in Australia. Women live on alone into their 80s and 90s. Men die when they get widowed.
That's very true, isn't it?
Yeah.
Women,
they can manage, they feed themselves, they clean themselves, but men end up living in one room in squalor.
Why is that?
Can you bring me some food? I just had a Vegemite sandwich yesterday for breakfast, and that's all I've had for 2 days because there's nobody to buy me bread. I mean, you know, it's tragic, but it happens all the time.
Really? Oh, I bet. Yeah, why is that? Why is it that...
Because men have always been waited on. Men have always had women around to do what they, you know. And I tell my sons, there are no women to wait on you anymore because women have come out of the closet. They're now out there in the workplace, and they're not going to cook for you. So you're going to have to learn these basic skills of stripping your bed, washing your sheets, ironing your shirts, and preparing and buying food. Otherwise, you're going to be legless.
Yeah, it's very good advice. But to be fair, I don't think it's just men being lazy. We've got a division of labour so that men have been responsible for earning the money.
Yes.
And therefore, often if a man dies and a woman is left as a widow, her standard of living will drop because she hasn't been doing that breadwinner.
No.
So it happens to both men and women, I guess, in different ways.
Yes.
Yeah.
But women can live on the smell of an oily rag.
And we give them pensions, whereas we don't give meals on wheels to every man. So we look after our women better than we look after our men.
Because women are organised and men aren't. And your program could be the opening gambit of an organisation that goes on to conquer these inequities. I encourage you to keep going.
Thank you so much. So, look, is there any other major points you'd like to make about men's health and
really.
What should men do?
I think the most important thing is learn how to cook.
Learn how to cook.
Read recipes, learn how to cook and practice cooking.
And lose weight.
And buy a slow cooker for winter. They're
right.
$35 or $40.
Yes.
You can prepare a meal before you go to work and have it ready, filling the house with nice smells when you come home.
Yeah, those, what do you call
crock
them?
Crock pots.
Crock pots, yeah. They're we've got one at home. Yeah, they're really handy.
They're great. Lovely to talk to you.
Look, people who want to follow more of your work, what's the site for the blog site?
Good question. I can never remember it.
All right. So if they just search King's Cross Doctor.
King's Cross Doctor.
And on the new Google blog.
I think it's King's Cross Doc.
KX Doc.
Yeah.
Right. And that's on Blogspot.
Lovely.
Yeah, great. That was Dr. Ray Seidler. He's one of the country's leading experts on men's and addiction issues. That was Dad's on the Air for June the 9th, 2009. We'll be back next week. Don't forget, you can listen to this program at dadsontheair.net. We are looking for people to get involved in the program and to help support us. If you're a volunteer, if you want to volunteer a few hours towards Dad's on the Air, or you have an interest in community radio or men's issues, please contact us through the website.
We ask all the questions that others don't dare.